Hello and welcome to the Future of Foam podcast. My name is Duncan Geddes and I run Technical Foam Services, the UK's finest foam conversion business based here in Corby. I've been in the foam industry for 30 odd years, so I know a lot of the industry's key players. This is the only podcast dedicated to the foam industry, so this is your chance to listen to the views of your peers. However, these episodes are a little bit different. Over the past year or so, discussions around head injuries in professional sport have become headline news, with rugby players taking governing bodies to court, and in football, the Premier League introducing concussion substitutions. As the number of ex-professionals sharing their experiences continues to increase, I wanted to investigate how foam in protective equipment is currently used for sports at all levels, and how headgear could be improved to increase protection for future generations. Today's episode is the final episode of our three-part series on sports safety. My guest is Saracens and United States fly half Will Hooley, who talked about his relationship with concussion as a current rugby union international. Will started his professional career at Northampton Saints in 2012, going on to have spells with Birmingham, Exeter and Bedford before joining Saracens in 2020. In 2018, Will was called up to represent the USA Eagles at international level, and he was named in the squad for the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platform or follow us on SoundCloud. You can also stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn and Facebook. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hi everybody, for our third edition of the Foam in Sport Safety podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by professional rugby player Will Hooley. Will's currently playing for Saracens, the well-known rugby club. So Will, thank you very much for joining us today. Really, really pleased that you've joined us. Tell us, first of all, just a little bit about your career, your rugby career today.
Well, first of all, Duncan, it's great to be on and thank you for having me. My sort of rugby journey, I'll try and keep it short. Look, I started when I was a youngster, and I really do mean that when I say youngster. I was 5 years old when I first sort of picked up the ball and kind of found a love for it. And really, ever since from then, played club, played county, played school, literally just played as much sport, but as much rugby as I could. And I kind of felt when I was a young age that I did want to become a professional rugby player and try and make it. And I managed to achieve that and am achieving that, playing for some unbelievable clubs, the likes of Northampton Saints, came right the way through the academy into the first team there. Enjoyed spells at Exeter Chiefs and then even at Bedford Blues and here at Saracens as well. On top of all of that, even though my accent doesn't give it away at all, but represented the USA in the international game. So, yeah, it's been a variety in my career as such, but I can't complain. It's been one that's given me a good amount of success.
Yeah, you've had a tremendous career. You're a fly half, aren't you? So, yeah, you've
always enjoyed... fullback, yeah. Exactly. Wherever I can play.
Yeah, so you've enjoyed being one of the glory boys, I take it.
Oh, I think, you know, I, from a young age, I wanted the ball in my hand. I wanted to be sort of influential in the team. It's, you know, I think 10 fly half, for anyone listening in who's a rugby fan will know, it's a pivotal position. It's kind of the, you know, captain of the ship. You've got to steer the team in the right direction. And there's times when it's tough, but there's most of the time I sort of really enjoy that aspect. But I also enjoy trying to do that as well from the backfield at 15, playing a similar role to a fly half. So, but like I say, you know, it's all about just getting on the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, you've played for some tremendous clubs. I mean, I'm completely biased here. I'm a big Northampton Saints supporter, so I've enjoyed watching you play at the Gardens a few times over the years. And I mean, you would have played with Stephen Myler. You presumably would have played with Gav Steenson, I take it, at Exeter. And obviously Owen Farrell nowadays. So you've played with some incredible fly halves. You must have learnt a bit from all of them as well. So and you've also played for the American team, haven't you? Didn't you go to the World Cup?
Yeah, indeed. That's got to be up there. Probably one of my, or is my highlight of my career. And I'm definitely searching to try and go to the next World Cup.
That would be an amazing achievement. What's it like playing for America when you're based in a European league? I mean, is it, do you, do you How does that work?
Yeah, not easy, isn't it? Look, we're similar to other international teams in terms of having international windows throughout the year. Probably we don't have as many windows as the likes of an England or an Ireland or a Wales with the Six Nations and everything. But we have the Americas Rugby Championship that goes ahead yearly, although COVID put a bit of a stop to that last year. November test window, summer test window. We've got a very exciting summer test window coming up when we're playing England at Twickenham and then Ireland in Dublin in the beginning of July, which is very exciting. And logistically, it's quite tough. Look, I think we're so used to it. We have players coming from America. We have players coming from Australia. We have guys playing in France. We're kind of used to just sort of coming in from, all different sort of directions and just cracking on with it.
Could you see yourself playing back in or playing in America at some point? Because, I mean, the American League's really picking up now, isn't it?
I mean, without a shadow of a doubt. I've already spoken to my fiance. We're getting married this summer and it's kind of...
Congratulations.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah. We're hopefully, fingers crossed, going to have it all go ahead smoothly. We've already talked about the ambition of going up there. We've got so many friends and even some family. And, I think, like you just said, it's such an exciting league, Major League Rugby out there for viewers who don't know what we're talking about. It's relatively new. It's a bit of a baby, really, in terms of in the rugby world. But I just think it's so exciting of where it can go. And ultimately, maybe I'm biased in saying this, but something about America and America sport, there's that nature of it of wanting to be bigger and better than, elsewhere. And if I can help that and bring my experience and try and push it on, then... That'd
well,
be brilliant.
Will, I'm sensing a Foden and Will Hooley podcast here, because Foden started doing one out there, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, Foz, bless him, he was always destined for some media gig, wasn't he? But look, honestly, I'm that's the other thing, off the pitch as well, the connections you make. And one thing I've massively learned since getting older is, you can be so het up in your rugby career, but actually you've got to look at the bigger picture. The opportunities outside of rugby and everything like that. Someone like Foden has done that, and certainly something I'm looking at as well.
Well, that actually leads me to my next question, Will, because you've taken a great step in terms of initiative, and you set up your own podcast, started doing that, which is the Next Step podcast, I believe. And it seems to me that you're using you've obviously got many, many contacts and friends in the rugby industry, and you've started talking to people about, what are they going to do after they transition from their rugby career? You've done, three episodes so far?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
I was listening to the Brad Barrett one the other day. That was fascinating. So, I mean, you've got a lot of high-profile friends in the sport. Where do you think your career's likely to go? Would you like to go into the media in due course?
Good question. I'm really sort of keeping my options open. The old saying of fingers in pies. And just to add another cliche in there, I think with the media side of things, particularly this podcast, which is called The Next Game, if anyone wants to have a look, The Next Game, A Story of Transition, is maybe my advice to anyone out there is don't leave broken glass behind you. So if you do pick up the phone and ask for someone for an interview, they don't think, oh God, that Will Hooley was the most annoying idiot in the world. My hope is that I'm a relatively, good guy, both on and off the field, and respected in those terms. And so, I've got some great friends that I've relied on and just said, look, would you be interested to come on the show?
That's a cracking idea, because I think what it shows, Will, is you've sort of stepped outside your comfort zone, haven't you? I mean, you've been part of a club environment for all those years. And what comes across when you speak to a lot of like rugby players as they're coming to the end of their rugby career is what they miss most of all is being part of that sort of team spirit, going in with the boys every day and training and doing all that kind of thing. So to step outside that environment is kind of really challenging. I'd imagine if you're doing that now whilst you're still playing rugby, it kind of shows that you're going to have a good career.
Yeah, well, I think I've always tried to make sure throughout my career that I'm doing things. Maybe that was my parents from a young age. It was never a complete emphasis on rugby. Rugby I knew would give me, and it has given me, an amazing career and people I've met and get paid to do what I've done. But I've tried to maintain to be busy. I've got a degree under my belt in sports journalism. I got a degree, part-time degree from the University of Staffordshire in sports broadcasting and journalism.
You do writing, don't you?
Yeah, so like all these things, and again, what I found is if you put yourself out there, well, it's not putting yourself out there, because I'm always very wary as to how you do that. I think for me, it's more a case of, right, you know, I wanted to do something which I was quite interested in. I enjoyed stories. I enjoyed writing stories. I enjoyed telling stories. And I enjoyed investigating stories. And it really sort of began at a bit of misfortune, which I had quite a bad injury. I had a bad concussion, ironically enough, and my time at Exeter Chiefs. And it was really from that whereby I was doing an Open University course, but I had to obviously kind of like stop and try and defer modules, whatever the word is. And anyway, it got to the point where I knew I had to kind of stop the year and would have to continue on to another year. But there was a point where I got well enough, fit enough that I was back, you know, wanting to be busy. And it was the media guy at Exeter Chiefs kind of turned around and be like, would you be interested in doing some writing for the Match magazine? And it honestly was really just from that, whereby I then got introduced to a guy who knew about this course at University of Staffordshire. And there was something really, like, I gained a lot of energy and a lot of sort of enjoyment through writing and doing these stories. And the next thing you know, to cut a long story short, is I ended up doing a degree in it. I ended up then meeting the head rugby writer at The Guardian, and then getting involved in freelance work for them, going to the World Cup and doing a sports blog. So it's amazing how, like, consequences, even if it might be bad, they can turn out to be, you know, good on the other side of things.
Yeah, something comes out of it. I think, actually, you've hit upon, like, a cracking angle on the world of sport there, because profile of the players within rugby on the whole is a lot lower than your mainstream sports like football and so forth. As I say, just referring to sort of Northampton Saints, I'm old school. I still buy a programme. Every home game, I buy a programme. And I find myself sort of kind of drawn towards the bits in the programme that talk about the players and, you know, what they enjoyed doing outside of the game and family life and all that sort of thing. So I think a lot of supporters, rugby supporters, we kind of want to learn and know more about the players. And it's, you don't see much written about many sort of like, you know, rugby players. So for somebody like you to kind of get the inside story on your fellow players is really good. I think it's quite interesting. To a supporter, we enjoy reading about you guys. And
yeah, I think there's an element as well that rugby needs to... I think there's twofold here. One, as a player, you're very aware that you don't want to sort of... At the end of the day, I am a rugby player. You know, where my bread and butter is, where I want to be the best at is being the best when I get on that rugby field and perform. So you don't want to let things get on top of you that, you know, puts you in jeopardy of not performing. But then there's the other side of the coin whereby rugby needs, I believe, to understand that we are not actually a very good business. I don't think we're very streamlined. I don't think we're very current. And I think there's a lot of aspects, and I won't mention names or anything like that, whereby the top of the tree of our sport, I still don't believe is really streamlined and in a 21st century way and doing the best it can for the sport. But I also think that players as well, with that, we've got to open ourselves up for the fans to be able to say that, you know, this is me, Will Hooley, who you see playing rugby, but also this is me as a person. I'm not going to just, you know, identify myself as the rugby player. I'm going to identify myself as a person.
Well, it's weird that, isn't it? Because, you know, especially at games, I think, you know, rugby players themselves are actually accessible. You know, I think on the whole, a lot of rugby players get that, because there's still an element of sort of like the amateur side to the sport. And, you know, you often see players wandering around the, you know, the stadiums and so forth, chatting to sort of supporters after the game or even before the game. Yet you never actually see much written about them on the whole, unless you go to a specific rugby magazine or something. So I think it'd be really good. I enjoy. I remember you wrote an article about Lee Dixon.
Yes.
He's gone off to become he's head of rugby, isn't he?
Yeah. Barnard Castle. Yeah. So that was, look, Lee's still a close mate of mine today. You know, I you've got to kind of pick what you want to talk about. I'm not going to be talking about how Saracens performed or Northampton Saints performed at the weekend as a current rugby player. I don't think that's correct. You leave that to the journalists, to the pundits. But what maybe as a current player you can do is just give that bit of insight as to, you know, well, what does someone go through? For Lee Dixon, he was going through retirement. And I just think it was fascinating, maybe as a current rugby player, to speak to him on those subjects. And, you know, I've gone so far and even created a podcast on it. So, yeah, it's something that fascinates me. And hopefully from a current rugby player perspective, then it's something that's just a little bit different.
I'm all for it. So it's the next game podcast is your... So who are you doing next then? Come on, you've had Gareth Stevenson.
Well, it depends when this comes out. I don't want to give too much away, but no, I'm really excited about the next episode to come out because I'm venturing into the women's game. And yeah, and it's something which, I'm not going to lie, I follow women's rugby, but not in detail. And I had a brilliant conversation with two legends of the game, but you know, I'm not going to say their names. Okay. Let you go on the podcast, the next game, a story of transition, but fascinating. We talk all about the women's game and how it's transformed. And
Saris have got a great ladies team, haven't they?
They have indeed.
And they do it properly.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it's, to be honest, the sport's going to a different stratosphere. You know, it's really exciting. I think where women's rugby is going.
Yeah, brilliant. Right, well, anyway, listen, enough talking about, you know, Saints and Saris and so forth. Right, the reason behind this podcast, and again, thank you so much, Will, for joining us. And as a professional rugby player, you are perfectly qualified to sort of answer our questions on this. But concussions in sport generally are becoming a bigger and bigger issue. And it strikes us that foam, which is my angle on this, is used within protective headgear. But it strikes me that sports are developing at such a pace, yet headgear, protective headgear, is not being developed at the same pace. Now, I know you mentioned that you use an N-Pro helmet, which I think, is that the most popular helmet within the sport of rugby?
No, I wouldn't say it is, because it's really quite new into the market. It has been around for a good few years, developed by a company out in Ireland. And the thing that really attracted me to it is this: they've genuinely gone out the way to search scientifically in terms of its design, but also the material it uses to get basically offer the most amount of protection. And whenever I talk about it, I absolutely say it is not going to stop concussion. At the end of the day, if you wear a crash helmet, you can still get concussed. You know, we don't need to go into the sciences of it, but in terms of how the brain moves and whatever. But I think for rugby, we know what we're getting ourselves into. Rugby is a contact game. There's going to be injury. And I think you have to accept that. It's not, ultimately, it's not life-threatening. You like to think it's not going to be life-threatening, but you have to accept there's going to be injury. But at the same time, can we get to a point as a sport where we limit risks, whether that's law changes, whether that's protective gear, whether that's just coaching of the tackle technique or whatever, to just make sure that we're in as a safe game as possible?
You know, you mentioned you obviously had quite a serious concussion when you were playing down at Exeter. Did that have an impact on your mental health when you came back? Was it difficult to come back after that injury and still throw yourself 100% into tackles and so forth?
I think it definitely impacted my mental health. I mean, if you spoke to my partner, I'm sure she'd tell you it impacted my mental health in general. You know, one of the concussion symptoms is kind of depression and feeling a bit sort of dark and upset about yourself. That's just the nature of it. It's the recognition that is symptoms. In terms of my genuine sort of belief when I came back, yeah, there was an element. And it actually was the first time after that concussion that I started wearing a helmet, because it just gets...
Is that what prompted it?
Yeah, but yeah, I never actually wore anything. I didn't, you know... I cracked on. But ultimately back then, I remember coming back and say I had some ups and downs with coming back from that injury. And when I eventually properly came back, it was an element of, I'm not putting this helmet on so I just shove my head in your deepest rucks and, you know, in bad places. It was more just to give me that sort of, right, you know, a flaring arm, a loose knee or boot, you know, I've got something that's going to give me something in return.
Do your teammates Obviously, they know what you've been through in terms of suffering from concussion. I'm sure a number of your teammates have suffered in the same way as well. Is there an increasing desire for players to wear helmets? Because you still don't see that many players wearing safety helmets, do you?
Yeah, again, I think it's really down to the fact that there is an understanding that, unfortunately, protective gear is not going to prevent. And I think that's the big word that people have to get around. There's no point selling a product where you're saying prevents you from concussion. Because, like I've literally said, you wear a crash helmet in rugby, there is still the opportunity, unfortunately, to get concussed. It's a contact sport. It's a lot of velocity. And unfortunately, mistakes happen. I do think there's the shift in the culture of our sport around concussion has massively changed, even in the 10 years that I've been playing professionally. You know, I mean that just in terms of, it's not this macho kind of world whereby, oh, I've got a bang on the head, but I'm going to be a top guy for the team, I'm going to crack on. And it's not about that. You know, ultimately, if I see my teammate who I know has had a bit of a bang on the head, I'm thinking to myself, right, is he okay? I'm looking at the doctor and I'm saying, look, he's, you know, you need to keep an eye. And in fact, we're in such a way with the sport now that we have independent doctors on the pitch, or not on the pitch, sorry, but on the sideline, whereby the it's taken out of your hands. There's no ifs, there's no buts. If it looks like someone has sustained a head injury impact, they will come off the pitch, they will be assessed. And there's actually such to a point whereby even if they think they're fine, they will still be brought off the pitch and removed from the field of play.
And rightly so as well, because I think, well, obviously in years gone by, you know, there was a desire, as you say, I'll be all right, I'll crack on, it's not a problem, it's just a bit of a bang on the head. And I think the damage can often be caused by playing on, and if you get a secondary, smaller bang and you're not 100% in the first place, it can cause a lot of long-term damage. So just out of curiosity, when you sign up then, because we all know about Steve Thompson and the struggles that he's got at the moment, do you sign almost like a disclaimer then when you enter the sport to say, you know, I accept I might suffer from concussion in years to come? How does that work?
No, look, I've got to be probably very careful. I've got to be very careful how I sort of answer this. And at the end of the day, what's happening with the likes in the media, which people might have seen around the concussion, and especially for those guys, the game 20 years ago is so different to the game we are in now. Now, there's elements of it whereby it's obviously more professional. Yes, guys are bigger. Yes, guys are quicker. And yes, the impacts are bigger. But the science, the medical care, the medical know-how around the game is of a different standard. And ultimately, I think that was only going to be the case through time, because people need to learn. But also, I think people are learning from the mistakes of the game and the mistakes of what's maybe gone before. Like I say, I'm certainly in no position to make comment on where they are at and what experiences they've gone through. I think you're totally right. If you have multiple dosage of head injury, you are more likely to sustain head injuries or maybe longer term effects. If you're in a position whereby you gain a head injury, you're seen medically properly, you're given the recovery time, you're looked after properly, and you do not return until correct, then you like to think that those instances, such as the guys that are obviously in the papers at the moment, are going to hopefully not happen.
So if you're, yeah, let's just say, you've taken a bang on the pitch, you know, you've been taken off because, you know, there's a concern that you might be concussed. But what sort of tests do they do, do the doctors do to check if you have been properly concussed? It's like the old ones, you know, I'll be holding up in front of your eyes and that kind of thing. But what other tests do the doctors do to check you out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not going to go through absolutely everything because we could be here all day. But ultimately, yeah, well, first of all, is the recognition of what's happened and obviously bringing the player off from the field of play. That, especially at the highest level that we're in, professional game, a lot of that is obviously done by the team doctor, but there's also independent doctors who are there at the game to basically take away that kind of, making sure there's a neutral aspect on it, neutral decision. That person has sustained a head injury. And then from there, it's very much whereby if someone is unconscious or whatever, you wouldn't even do what we call a scat test. You'd even just, frankly, it would be recognised as removed and basically that person recover in a period when then he can perform the SCAT test. And the SCAT test involves a whole range of...
What's the SCAT test?
So that involves a whole range of things, from remembering words to remembering numbers to walking along a line to balancing with your eyes closed, remembering those words and numbers again at the end, how you're feeling. It might be that you're nauseous or whatever. So basically, ultimately in rugby, you've got, I think it's at least 5 minutes, maybe even longer now, 5 minute period of getting those tests in, getting those results, and then it's very much from there a decision can be made whether a player comes or back onto the field of play. If I'm honest, particularly in the last few years, it's the percentage of people who go back onto the field is very small. I think ultimately, yeah, if it's a maybe, it's just they get removed.
Yeah, play safe and stay off the pitch, isn't it?
So. Yeah.
Do you, I mean, obviously, I know you're heavily involved in Saris, and you talked about, obviously, the women's team there. Do you look at how kids' rugby takes place and you know, how welfare is of kids in terms of headgear? Do you ever see sort of kids training nearby? Do you have a view on should kids wear safety headgear when they're training? I'm thinking 8, 9, 10 years old, starting the sport, you know, maybe their heads and skulls aren't fully developed.
I think again, and I've said this now a couple of times, it's kind of twofold. I think there's an element if you give a kid, I know if you gave me a lovely brand new helmet and said I have to wear that, there's going to be an element of me be like, right, I am going to just throw myself around. I'm going to be Superman wearing this.
Yeah.
So there's an element of that. I think one of the big things is coaching. You know, how are we building contact and tackling and rugby contact drills? How are we building that in into a player's sort of development? I personally disagree with people saying people shouldn't do contact until they're 16. Because ultimately, if you're only doing contact training at 16, you've missed a whole how many years of training and understanding the technical aspects. Because a lot of the thing is, if I'm honest, Duncan, like technically...
It's bad tackling.
Exactly. Or bad carrying of the ball, or bad rucking, or bad, you know, in the air, or whatever it might be, or not understanding the rules, for example. And that, to be honest, is education. And I think that's probably one of the big things. And then if you sit that alongside protection to make sure that maybe it is kids wear protection to get their technique better, so that if they do make mistakes, they've got something whereby they have got a form of protection.
Well, I'm with you all the way. I think, and you sometimes read about this now with the professional club saying that to, you know, reduce the risk of concussion, you know, there shouldn't be so much sort of full-on tackling during coaching. It's all very well, but unless you actually teach tackling, and tackling is a skill, an art, there's no two ways about it, unless youngsters and professional players practice it, you're not going to get better at it, and therefore, if you don't get better at it, you're going to be more at risk.
Yeah.
So I think that's the wrong way of going about it. My problem with youth rugby, and I'm speaking as a dad who's, my middle son played a lot of rugby till the age of about 15, was a lot of youth rugby coaches are, without being unkind, they're well-meaning dads, or maybe, you know, middle-aged guys that played a bit of rugby in their youth and, you know, don't want to quite give up, if you see what I mean. So their way of giving something back to the sport is to bring their lads along on a Sunday morning. They'll coach the under 10s, under 11s, under 12s, and, you know, they might not have the right coaching techniques in terms of teaching lads how to tackle. And I'm sure a lot of damage does get done in the early ages to schoolboys and young lads, young girls as well, obviously, that just aren't being coached properly.
And that, yeah, and that's the one thing. Look, this is a sport that obviously both you and I love and want to see do well. There's always going to be incidents, unfortunately, and accidents and injuries within this game because it's a contact game. And I think so long as you can understand that and realise that, well, then you go into then how can we best make it a safer game? And then that comes, like we just talked, education, protection, and ultimately then therefore understanding of what concussion is. So, you know, it's all three parts.
So, okay, so on that note then, Will, you're in charge of the old RFU. a bit of promotion here. You know, how would you make rugby a safer game, starting from you know, the sort of the youth years? Is it more about, it's not just about equipment, I get that, it's about education. Is there enough, bit of a big question is there enough education given to youngsters about the dangers of tackling and the need to learn more about tackling from the beginning? Our kids, let me ask you this, are kids just thrown out on a rugby pitch and, like, you know, there you go, tackle? Because, you know, tag rugby takes them up to what, the age of 8, I think, something like that. So you sometimes see these kids at like 8, 9 years old running around a rugby pitch, flying into each other. Yeah, it can't be doing them any good. And you get some big lads at the age of 8 and 9, believe me.
No, look, I think, well, first of all, my loyalties are with USA Rugby, so they are a few can do what they wish. But unfortunately, it comes down to where our game is at, and obviously the pandemic that's been, and the resources that we have and the money that we have in our game. It's all well and good us sitting here and saying this needs to be done, this needs to be done. The fact of the matter is unfortunately, it's just not as easy as saying that and then doing it. I do think one of the biggest things around rugby at the moment is a lot of stuff has just popped out in the media. And I think there's also this element of, like, we forget how good our sport is in so many other areas. You know, what it brings to you in terms of learning about teamwork, learning about passion and desire and work rate and sportsmanship and all things like that. You know, our game is up there, as they always say. You know, it's the game played by gentlemen, the game that is for thugs or something like that, isn't it? And but that's the case. There are so many brilliant things of our sport. Let's not get absolutely carried away with the fears around the contact element. Because, for example, my kids, and hopefully I have kids one day, and if they look to go into rugby, I will not be sort of putting fear into their minds of what this, what that. I would just make sure that hopefully they're in the best environment to learn, that they enjoy it, that they get the best coaching. And yeah, if there's an element of, like, protection around that as well, then I would probably be quite keen to advocate that. But I do believe the whole scaremongering around contact and rugby, and hearing these things such as, oh, shouldn't it be allowed in schools up until the age of... I just, like, you know, what world are we living in at the moment? Rugby has been around since the 1800s, and we have some bad examples, obviously, and horrific, and I feel incredibly sorry for those people. But there is a complete minority here. Let's not forget about all the good things, but let's also focus on making sure that we're trying to make it as safe as possible.
Well, I'm with you all the way there. I think, unfortunately, it's the 1%, or probably even less, it's the 1% that get hurt that bring 99% of the negative publicity. And, yeah, there's been a lot of rugby played on a lot of pitches for a long, long, long time. And it is sad, isn't it? It's the occasional injury that gets all the publicity. So do you think, I mean, Will, this has been great talking to you. We ought to kind of wrap this up, really. I mean, you're obviously still wearing headgear. I mean, looking at the Sarri squad at the moment, do you think that, you know, your squad players will wear headgear, or do you think the squad players as they are at the moment, are they quite comfortable with their own situation? And I'm talking at professional level now, obviously.
Everyone's different. You know, everyone's different. Everyone has their own history. And, you know, I've had some concussions in my career, a fair few head bangs in my career, and obviously would like to have not had those head bangs, but it is what it is. But therefore, my past has made me educate myself in terms of why I would wear headgear. Do I think, you know, more players in the future will wear it? Yes, I do believe that, because of what's been talked about and said, and it kind of makes common sense. Do I believe that rugby players, all of them will, and no, because at the end of the day, someone might have been playing for the last 12, 15 years, hasn't really experienced much of a head injury. They don't wear, you know, it is a personal thing. So long as we are, again, we're educating and we're making sure that players know what's happening, know what's on offer to them, then I believe then people can make good, educated decisions on it all.
Okay, it's all about education, isn't it, Will? So go on then, do you think Sarri's will go back up?
I think obviously I'm going to be positive.
It's looking good.
No. Well, look, it's been a weird old season with the Premiership. Then we had some cup competition at the Championship. I can't believe it's the end of coming towards the end of May. But we're in a good position. Just got to get the job done.
Yeah. And are you with the Saris next season?
I can't confirm nor deny anything. So unfortunately, I can't be saying anything on here.
Well, Will, wherever you end up playing next season, if it's with Saris, I wish you all the very best. If you come back to the Saints, I mean, there you go. The number one club in England. There's a thought. But Will, I wish you the very, very best of your, this season, next season, and wherever you play after that. And if you end up playing in America one day, that'd be an interesting challenge for you. I can see that working out.
Yeah, well, stay tuned. You never know.
All right. Will, thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
Thank you. Cheers.
That was Will Hooley. Please listen to his podcast as well, titled The Next Game, A Story of Transition. It's an absolutely brilliant podcast. I always listen to it. Thank you very much, Will, for making that a fun and interesting conversation. As this is the end of our series, I'd also like to thank Dr. Gray and Ewan Roberts for their time and their insights. Thanks for listening to the Future of Foam podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you like what you hear, why not share it with your colleagues, and don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And I hope you'll join us next time as I speak to more people from inside the foam industry about the future of foam.